This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, it's reported that one out of eight known species of plants is threatened with extinction or nearly extinct. What does this mean? Can anything be done? Freshwater mussels are also in big trouble in the United States, and many are extinct, but efforts are now underway to save those that remain. Old Testament Isaiah envisioned beating swords into plowshares in times of peace. In our time, the Navy finds it more difficult to recycle bombs into fuel. And in Georgia, the Dahlia onions are being picked by hand. It's part of the Great American Harvest. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. It's springtime, and plants are appearing everywhere. Meantime, the World Conservation Union has concluded a research project that's been in progress for 20 years. Collaborating scientists have reached some startling conclusions about plant life around the globe.
What the report tells us is that one out of eight plants in the world are at risk of extinction, and in the United States, the figure is larger than that. In the United States, we now know that nearly 30% of the plants in the United States are at risk of extinction.
That was Deborah Jensen, director of the Conservation Science Division for the Nature Conservancy. Loss of biodiversity, the term frequently applied to the extinction of plant life, will have a severe economic consequence both in terms of food, fiber, and medicine. Jensen, like most researchers of the subject, says there are strong economic reasons for protecting biodiversity. A quarter of our medicines are derived from plants, and 50% are derived from plant derivatives. New England suffered huge losses when the commercially valuable chestnut tree was killed off by a pathogen which came from abroad. While there are strong philosophical reasons for saving plants from extinction, the economic interests should help impel action.
So I think this is an issue that we have only relatively recently become aware of its importance. And if we tackle it for commercial purposes, we'll also solve the problem for conservation purposes. And so I guess the short form on what we need to do about plant conservation is know what plants to conserve, know where they live, conserve good examples of their habitat, have good management practices, and reduce the key threats.
Andrew Dobson, associate professor at Princeton University and a specialist on conservation of world biodiversity, cautions that economic forces are working against tropical forests, even though in the long term, the forests are more valuable if left standing.
So I think we have to emphasize the longer term value of trees, and particularly tropical forests and the plants that are in those, rather than the sort of short term economic value you get from chopping those things down. And in particular, the present economic climate, which encourages people to pay off their long-term debts by chopping down trees, is one that's only going to lead to more destruction of tropical forests. So we have to find ways of saying, no, forests are much more valuable than their simple value as timber, that the world's total tropical timber budget is a mere $9 billion a year, which seems a big number. But if you compare that to the world pharmaceutical budget, which is more of the order of $300 billion, or perhaps $3 trillion, then the value of forests as sources of new drugs hugely outweighs their value just as new furniture.
On conservation strategy, both Jensen and Dobson agree that hotspots should be preserved. These are areas of great biological diversity which are essential to prevent extinction and to maintain the biological capital necessary to bring plants back to places where they've disappeared. But Dobson says we don't know enough to do the job properly.
Many groups of organisms, there's just a huge ignorance about what is where. And when you consider it's things like nematodes and fungi that perform the vital processes that make nature function, it's appalling to me that we know so little about how those species are distributed. And although we might be able to identify hotspots where high densities of plants, birds, mammals coincide, We know nothing about the engines of ecosystems, the species like nematodes, fungi, and mycorrhizae, and whether they will also be in those hotspots. Our assumption is that they are, but you know, it's appalling that we have such detailed maps of the universe, you know, all the stars from which we will gain zero, yet we have a very poor knowledge of all the species upon which human life depends.
Speaking for the Nature Conservancy, Deborah Jensen says to preserve biodiversity, it is also necessary to look beyond hotspots. There are places which must be protected if a single species is to survive. Sometimes these can be in heavily populated areas. In Marin County, near San Francisco, where 6 million people live, a rare lily exists which is not found any other place in the world. The Conservancy acquired a grassy knoll to preserve the lily, and the area is now a park which enhances the neighborhood as well. To protect biodiversity, humankind faces a challenge which cannot be compartmentalized into a single cause and effect. Again, Andrew Dobson.
The problem with biodiversity is that we're dealing with everything else that inhabits the planet. We don't even know to within 2 or 3 million how many other species there are. We're beginning to see that we have a massive dependence on those species. I mean, humans will not be the last species to go extinct. Therefore, we have to emphasize that we are much more dependent on biodiversity than it actually is on us. And perhaps, you know, we spend or waste huge amounts of money on advertising, but perhaps more of that money could emphasize the value of the things that nature is providing for us, such as drugs, food, the air we breathe, the water we drink, etc.
While protecting biodiversity is a daunting task, progress is being made in the United States with programs such as the Nature Conservancy's Natural Heritage Program. The program identifies and protects a wide spectrum of plant habitats and provides information on a state-by-state basis so informed land use choices can be made. For hundreds of years, freshwater mussels have been used for food, tools, and ornamentation. Native Americans made spoons and plates and jewelry out of the shells, and mussels are still used today in the cultured pearl and jewelry industries. These are trades that provide employment to some 10,000 residents, mainly in the Mississippi River Basin. More importantly, though, these bivalves play a significant biological role in freshwater ecosystems. Yet some of these species have become extinct, and dozens more are threatened, especially in the southeastern United States. In an effort to reverse this trend, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is implementing a recovery program. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has the story.
The recovery plan is a national effort with much of the focus on waterways in Kentucky, Tennessee, southwestern Virginia, northern Alabama, and northern Georgia. That's because 90% of the nation's mussel species are located there, areas that are some of the most diverse freshwater ecosystems in the world. In fact, the Tennessee River was at one time paved with mussels, especially in the shallower parts of the river. But things have changed dramatically. According to Dick Biggins, Fish and Mussel Recovery Coordinator for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Asheville, North Carolina.
The nation has about 300 species of freshwater mussels. About 95% of those freshwater mussels existed in this area one time. Currently, nationwide, there's 70 species of mussels that are listed as endangered. There's another about 19% that we're sort of looking at that may have problems sufficient enough that they might need federal protection. There's no other group of animals in North America that have been hit this hard in recent times.
Biggins adds that there are just a few streams remaining in the southeast with significant mussel populations today. Experts say there are a number of reasons why mussels are dying, but the biggest cause is impoundments, built earlier this century. Dr. Richard Neves is a research biologist for the Biological Resource Division of the U.S. Geological Survey at Virginia Tech, located in Blacksburg, Virginia. He has studied the reproductive biology and life cycles of freshwater mussels for the past 20 years and is playing an important role in the recovery plan.
These animals developed and adapted to running water systems. And so when the dams were put in, they backed the water up, they could not tolerate standing water conditions and the sedimentation that went along with it, and so they disappeared. But in addition to the dams, you have an awful lot of water pollution that has had historic impacts, habitat destruction, The biggies right now, I think, are probably non-point source pollution, just runoff from the land as a result of development, and the sedimentation that comes with it. Basically, it tends to choke out the bottoms of these streams where a lot of these invertebrates reside right now.
Some mussel populations have even stopped reproducing. Just another part of this environmental puzzle experts are trying to piece together. In an effort to improve mussel populations, part of the recovery plan includes allowing mussels to reproduce in the lab and reintroduce them to the environment. In fact, Dr. Neves has four federally protected species in his lab that he hopes will one day be reintroduced. The Lower French Broad River below the Douglas Reservoir in Tennessee is among the waterways being targeted as possible reintroduction sites. However, introducing the animals to their environments won't help if the dams aren't taken down and the pollutants cleaned up, something Dick Biggins says is finally occurring in some rivers and streams.
We see power companies and other organizations, agencies like the Tennessee Valley Authority, looking at their releases below their reservoirs and improving their reservoir release programs so that the water quality below some of these reservoirs is coming back. Although we have the impounded reaches of the river where the mussels have not done well and probably will never do well, at least certain species, the areas below the reservoirs where we have free-flowing water, as long as we have sufficient water and it's close to what the temperatures of that water were historically, and the oxygen concentration is close to what it was historically, then we can bring back some of our mussel populations to below some of these reservoirs.
In addition, Biggin says U.S. Fish and Wildlife and other organizations are working to repair stream banks and watersheds so that rivers won't carry the pollution and sediment. The 35 mussel species that are extinct are obviously gone forever. The goal now is to try to prevent the same from happening to dozens more, which will not be an easy job. While saving mussel species doesn't stir public sentiment like whales, dolphins, or seals, Dr. Neves says mussels are just as, if not even more important.
They were the natural filtration system in our rivers. They filter particles from the water column, so in essence they help to purify the water. They served as food for wildlife. Various species of wildlife ate freshwater mussels, including the Native Americans. That was a big food source for them, especially in the southeastern United States. And the balance of these systems has changed. Without the filtration system, the tendency is for a lot of the sediment and other things to get into the river to remain in suspension because nothing is pulling them out of the water column.
With countries across the globe depleting their natural resources and biological diversity, Dr. Neves says it is even more critical that the United States takes a proactive role in restoring habitats. He says it would be a tragedy if the world's largest array of freshwater mussels was allowed to become extinct. Something that could happen if efforts to improve southeastern waterways aren't continued. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
This is The Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley, and The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CARHERE. Are there threatened plants in your neighborhood? Give us a call. The number is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. Email is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. In the Old Testament, Isaiah gives us a vision of the ultimate in recycling, where swords are beaten into plowshares in a world which has achieved peace. In today's world, we have more swords and a great need for plowshares or productive tools, but when the sword is napalm and the recycling is to take place half a continent away, obstacles arise that Isaiah never anticipated. It all began when the Navy decided to dispose of Vietnam-era napalm, which it is storing in 34,000 canisters at the Fallbrook Weapons Station in California. It signed a contract with a company in Indiana called Pollution Control Industries, which agreed to take the napalm and turn it into fuel for plants which manufacture cement.
Well, what the current plan is and what was going to be accomplished in Indiana was that the napalm would arrive and would be blended with other industrial byproducts, which are routinely sent to treatment companies around the country. There it would be blended and turned into a specification fuel, which would be burned in the place of fossil fuels in the cement kilns.
That was Lieutenant Commander John Smith, who is the spokesperson for the Naval Facility Engineering Command in Washington, D.C. Robert Campbell, CEO of PCI Industries, says the process is straightforward and replaces dirtier fuels.
Well, we do this every day of the week. That's what we do. We're a permitted Part B RCRA facility, permitted by U.S. EPA and also Indiana Department of Environment. And when we recycle these basically flammable materials, last year we recycled 15,000 different types, of which napalm would have been one, and into a usable fuel. And that's a fuel by specification that is burned at high temperatures and permitted also US EPA permitted cement kilns. And what these cement kilns do is they use recycled hazardous waste components like the napalm material as a fuel, and it replaces coal or actually number six fuel oil. In this particular instance, we would have replaced 6 million gallons of number six fuel oil, or we would have replaced 56 million pounds of coal.
To get the napalm from California to Indiana, some of it was loaded on a railroad car and shipped across the country, a process which came to the attention of Democratic Congressmen Blagojevich and Lipinski from Illinois. They questioned the safety of moving napalm through their districts. The Navy says shipping napalm, a jelly-like goo which does not have the fuses and igniters that cause it to explode in a bomb, is safe. Again, Lieutenant Commander Smith.
What it is, it's a mixture of gasoline, benzene, which I guess most people would be accustomed to smelling when they fill up their car with gas, that's the odor, and then polystyrene, which is used commonly in the making of children's toys and plastic lawn furniture, for instance. And that's exactly what it is. It's a very stable substance, relatively low volatility when you look at a lot of commercially transported items across the country. It will not explode, for instance, whereas a tanker of, let's say, gasoline would explode, napalm will not explode.
Despite the Navy's assurances and editorial support for the project from two major Chicago newspapers, opposition continued. The tank car of napalm got as far as Kansas City. At that point, the Environmental Protection Agency advised PCI that it was in violation of certain federal requirements for accepting waste unrelated to napalm. EPA says this was coincidental. Campbell, from PCI, thinks politics was involved.
Well, it just became a political arena. A lot of politicians had their own particular agenda, and it's a shame because it was absolutely the right environmental method for recycling this, and we were the right company to do it. But as a result of this, the environment suffers because the politics of this situation would not allow it to happen.
The net result is that the tank car full of napalm was turned around and sent back to California where it started from. The napalm experience tells us that public opinion and our elected representatives can indeed make a difference. If the Navy is right that shipping napalm is a lot safer than shipping gasoline and other inflammables that pass us in trailer trucks every day, it needs a modern-day Isaiah who can convince the critics that the napalm sword can indeed be turned into a useful fuel without endangering the bystanders. In preparing this report, we did not have time before deadline to find out whether the Old Testament is a standard reference for the Navy Public Affairs Office. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Right now, Vidalia onions are being harvested in southeastern Georgia. It's part of the Great American Harvest. The onions are planted in September or October and are harvested from now until May and June. They're called short day onions because the bulbs grow during the short days of winter. George Boyan, an extension horticulturalist at the University of Georgia, says this year's crop looks promising.
We had a little bit of cold weather early on, earlier in the season, about a month or so ago, that they were concerned about. But onions are pretty cold hardy, and it didn't get cold enough to really do much damage. So it looks like it's going to be a pretty good year this year for them. And one of the big changes that's, I think, going to really start in earnest this year for the industry is they're probably going to be adopting mechanized harvesting. Most other onions, storage-type onions or common onions, are harvested with machinery. The onions here have traditionally been harvested by hand. And so it looks like some of the bigger growers are going to start using some of that equipment and seeing if they can't save a little money and do a little bit better job in handling the onions.
Vidalia onions were first discovered in Georgia in the 1930s by farmer Mose Coleman. He found that the onions he planted did not have the pungent flavor of a normal onion and that these vegetables were actually sweet. Coleman was able to sell his first harvest, and from then on, the popularity of the unique onion grew. Other farmers were soon growing them, and the growers would gather at a market in the small town of Vidalia, Georgia, to sell them, hence the name. George Boyan says Vidalias are similar in appearance to some other onions.
It's a yellow onion, and it's sort of top-shaped. We use the term, we call it a Granix-type onion. Granix was one of the original varieties that were developed to be grown as a Vidalia onion. And its heritage actually comes out of the Bermuda onions. And it's a somewhat flattened onion from top to bottom and yellow. The size of them can be, anywhere from 2 inches across up to 4 inches or more. So it's a fairly large onion.
There are about 250 farmers in a 20-county area of Georgia that are growing Vidalia onions. The popularity of Vidalias has grown so much that it was named the state vegetable of Georgia. Today, they contribute about $60 million to the state's economy. The most notable thing about Vidalia onions, though, is the flavor. And George Boyan says the reason for this is rooted in dirt.
One of the unique things about this part of Georgia is the soils. They are sandy loam and sandy soils, which means that they tend to have low sulfur content in the soil. And it's sulfur that gives onions, it's primarily due to the variety. We have a low pungency onion, but if you have high sulfur soils, the onions tend to be hotter or more pungent. And because of the unique soils in this part of the state, they tend to have relatively low sulfur content, and because of that, because of the low sulfur content, the onions are particularly mild, or what we call a sweet onion.
Vidalia onion tart and Vidalia onion pie are among the dishes featuring this sweet vegetable. George Boyan also recommends hollowing out the top of a Vidalia, filling it with butter, a bouillon cube or Tabasco sauce, and baking the onion at 350 degrees for 30 to 40 minutes. And for those suffering from halitosis or bad breath, the mild nature of Vidalia onions could be the saving grace, especially for those who have suffered from their co-workers' ingestion of the infamous cucumber onion salad. Thanks for listening. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a scientist studying the meteorite collision that impacted the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and was responsible for the extinction of the dinosaurs tells us what happened. We talk green about Rocky Flats, Colorado, and the effort to clean up the nuclear weapons production facility there. We go to Los Llanos, the windswept plains of Colombia in South America. It's the big wet desert which begins where the rainforest stops. Stay with us. Last month, astronomers told us that an asteroid would come close to hitting the Earth in 30 years. After recalculating the numbers, though, scientists determined that the large object would miss the planet by several hundred thousand miles. But millions of years ago, a giant meteorite collided with the Earth with a force so great its impact was felt worldwide. Many scientists believe it was this collision along the Yucatan Peninsula that led to the extinction of the dinosaurs and many other species. Timothy Brelauer, professor of geology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, is among a group of scientists researching effects of the collision on land and sea. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott recently spoke with Professor Brelauer about his research.
What was the Yucatan Peninsula like at the before, during, and after the collision?
The Yucatan Peninsula about 65 million years ago was a very shallow sea like the Bahamas today. On the north side of the sea, there was a very great drop-off, an escarpment, a very steep escarpment down to the depths of the Gulf of Mexico. So I think you have to imagine a very shallow sea with corals and ancient ancestors of corals growing in it like the Bahamas today.
And what happened at the time of impact and after the collision?
Well, the current belief is that the meteorite came in from the south, traveling towards the north. And we currently believe that the meteorite was about 6 miles across. And this dug a huge crater, about 120 miles wide. The energy involved in this collision was equivalent to 1 million atomic bombs. And this is actually equivalent to a magnitude 13 earthquake, which is 1 million times more energy than any recorded historic earthquake. So it was truly tremendous amount of energy. And what we believe is that this energy was transmitted towards the north, and this led to massive collapse, fragmentation of the front of the Yucatan Peninsula. And this fragmentation triggered huge submarine landslides or submarine avalanches that traveled down through the Gulf of Mexico at speeds of hundreds of miles an hour, churning down through the Gulf and creating a large amount of destruction. Some of these avalanches may actually have reached into the Caribbean, and that's where we originally found this unusual layer.
What have you been looking for in your research, and how is the research conducted in terms of methodology?
We've been looking at cores drilled by the Ocean Drilling Program in the previous deep sea drilling project, which were taken in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Caribbean. And in these cores, we have found a mixture of materials which were derived during the blast of the impact called spherules. These are little melt drops, round, beady melt drops. And these are mixed with fragments of the front of the Yucatan Peninsula. So rock fragments such as limestone and granite from the front of the peninsula mixed with beady spherules indicate that the two particles were derived at the same time during the blast of the impact. That's our major evidence.
Why is this important to us?
Well, everybody knows that the blast of the impact indirectly caused the extinction of the dinosaurs and a host of other organisms living at the time. I think the major implications of our research is that the blast of the impact also had a tremendous effect on the morphology of the Gulf of Mexico, on the deep sea morphology of the Gulf of Mexico and even in the Caribbean. And we now need to look at various aspects of the morphology of the Gulf of Mexico and look at this and see what the exact effects were. But I think we're at the tip of the iceberg here. The other thing that the blast did was that the submarine avalanches displaced a huge amount of water, and this displaced water traveled along the surface of the Gulf of Mexico as giant tidal waves or tsunamis, which then struck the Gulf Coast of the United States and the northeast coast of Mexico. These huge meters or tens of meter waves caused mass destruction along those coastlines as well. Maybe the things that we're finding will help other geologists identify other sedimentary deposits that have resulted from other impacts in the geologic records. These deposits are very difficult to identify, and they're often very controversial. For one thing, the craters that have resulted from these ancient collisions are usually buried very deep within the earth, and they're very hard to identify. And once you've identified them, they're very difficult to date with any precision. The other thing that is very hard to do is to connect that crater with major mass extinction events that are known to occur in the geologic record. So it's quite often we observe, paleontologists will observe a major mass extinction event of a number of different species in the record, and they will not be able to determine whether this resulted from an impact or such as the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary. I think our research will help other geologists identify the sedimentary deposits that result from major collisions of extraterrestrial bodies with the Earth, and that way they will be able to link the collisions with the extinction events. So I think that's one of the most far-reaching implications of our research.
That was Professor Timothy Brailauer, geologist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, talking about his research on the meteorite that collided with the Earth more than 60 million years ago. We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to talk about one of those byproducts of the Cold War that will probably last a lot longer than the memories of what the Cold War was all about. And that's nuclear waste that is accumulated at the 53-some-odd sites around the country where nuclear projects were conducted. And the Department of Energy has just produced a draft strategy. They call it Accelerating Cleanup, Paths to Closure, to deal with the problem in the various sites. And DOE, as I understand it, says it's going to cost about $147 billion and take more than 70 years to deal with this issue. And the public comment period on the plan, if you want to tell DOE what you think about it, ends on May 1. And so far, closure dates have been set only for two sites, and one of them is Rocky Flats, which is outside Denver, Colorado. So we're going to be talking to some of the folk who are involved with that today. And if you have views about nuclear waste from weapons production, give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests are Jesse Roberson, and she is manager of the Rocky Flats Field Office in Colorado, and she is with the Department of Energy, and Tom Marshall. And he is from the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center, which is a citizen group that's been monitoring the operation, and he's also a spokesperson for that organization. So, Jesse Roberson from DOE, let's start with you. What is happening at Rocky Flats now? Those of us that have driven by it see it as a big empty space with a lot of birds on it.
Well, Peter, what we're doing right now are disassembling buildings. We're removing special nuclear material from the site, waste. We're stabilizing materials within those structures that still exist at the site. Basically, we are methodically removing materials from piping and ductwork, stabilizing that material, packaging it, and shipping it from the site.
Now, that material is radioactive, as I understand it. Is that?
This includes nuclear materials, special nuclear materials.
Right. And so, Tom Marshall from the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center, how is this operation going from your perspective?
As we see it, they are really still at the beginning stages of addressing the problem. And the problem, as you pointed out, is the accumulation of very hazardous materials, radioactive materials, and hazardous chemicals, heavy metals, that sort of thing. Our hope is that this will conclude in a responsible way, in a way that provides for the safety of the people living around the site currently and long into the future. One of the problems is that some of these materials will remain dangerous for thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years. Plutonium will remain dangerous for 240,000 years, and that's the primary contaminant of concern at the site.
And I suspect that by the end of that period, you and your group will probably not be able to check it out.
We will probably not be able to, and that's one of the concerns, really, is what will the situation be over the years? What institutions will remain to watch over the site? Because the Department of Energy at this point does not plan to clean up the site to pristine levels, and they don't have the technology to do so right now. So our concerns are, how clean do we get it, and how do we make sure that somebody doesn't build a school or a nursery school or something like that on the site in the future?
Well, Jesse Roberson from DOE, how do you deal with the issue that Tom raises?
Mm-hmm.
How do you figure out how clean to get it, and how do you give the citizens of Denver and Colorado the assurance that, in fact, this is going to be okay, since I think most of us have had experiences in which we're assured that there is no contamination problem or whatever, only to find years later that things didn't go as we hoped.
Well, Tom, what we have to depend on is the best technology and information that we have available, and that is what we're trying to do. That isn't to say in 40 years or in 100 years that there isn't more information or better technology. And the way that we deal with that is to institutionalize within the government the actions that we took and the basis for those actions, so that future generations can have that information and make determinations at those times when they have that information.
Now,
what,
Tom,
if any action?
I believe, I don't know whether your group was a party to it, but I think there's been a lot of litigation about the Rocky Flats site, hasn't there, in which citizens have felt that they just were not assured by government action?
There is a variety of ongoing litigation for different purposes. Much of that is vested in the fact that there hasn't been a lot of free flow of information over past years. That's true.
Tom, where do you folks come out on that? Do you feel you've been excluded from the process?
At this point, the public is getting more information from the Department of Energy than we have ever gotten in the past. However, when we look at public participation, I characterize the door as being half open or half shut, however you would like to look at it. We get a lot of information, but it's not clear how far the input from the public goes in terms of affecting Department of Energy decisions or the decisions of the regulating agencies. And a good case in point is the cleanup levels that we were talking about. The Department of Energy, in conjunction with the state of Colorado and the Environmental Protection Agency, set what I will term cleanup levels. The site calls them soil action levels for plutonium in the soil that are tens of thousands of times higher than average background levels for the Front Range area where Rocky Flats is. Now, those proposed cleanup levels met with near universal opposition from the public in this area. Nevertheless, the Department of Energy and the regulating agencies have gone ahead and set those levels. We are now in the process of hopefully instituting an independent review of those cleanup levels.
So Jesse, Tom is saying you're not going to make it clean enough. Is he right?
I'm aware of that, and I certainly respect Tom's opinion. Once again, we have to make the best decisions we can based on the technology and the information we have. And Tom is absolutely right. We haven't done this. Department of Energy hasn't done this in isolation. We worked very closely with the state of Colorado as well as the Environmental Protection
Agency. So how do you figure out what is clean enough? How did you approach it in Rocky Flats?
This is primarily a process based in with the Environmental Protection Agency, who has the responsibility for making those determinations across the country.
So they set the level, and then you clean up to what they are
responsible for the processes and the science that is the basis for those determinations.
Well, are you comfortable that a level which Tom says is many times higher than the background level is an adequate approach to this problem?
Well, Tom and I don't necessarily agree on that, but I do agree with Tom that there are some citizens around the site who are not happy with the levels that have been set. And we, the Department of Energy, are certainly trying our best to help sponsor an independent initiative by some of the citizens to understand and review and offer feedback to the agencies, not just the Department of Energy's, on the soil action levels that have been set.
Well, let's step back from this for a moment and ask ourselves, is it appropriate for citizens to say, we want it cleaned up back to the way it was before you started? We want to make sure that whatever could have happened there before the projects began could happen again. Is that an unrealistic approach?
Why don't I take the first cut at that? I don't think it's an unrealistic approach at all. As a matter of fact, there was an entity called the Rocky Flats Future Site Use Working Group, which issued a report in 1995. This was a broad-based group that included environmental interests, business interests, local government interests, worker interests, etc. And one of the consensus recommendations of that group was that the site should be cleaned up to average background levels for the area when technology allowed for that in a cost-effective and ecologically sensitive manner.
And who knows what that means, given cost-effectiveness is so tough to figure out.
What it means and what it says is that the goal should be to attain those background levels, and that we understand that that's not going to be easy, that we don't have the technology for that right now, but that the federal government should be committed to trying to develop such technology.
And Peter, in our cleanup agreement with the state and the Environmental Protection Agency, we have also included and embraced that goal as well.
And so the issue, of course, is when you get there and when the technology is available and how to get there. And
right.
Do I take it, Jesse, that you're not there now, that even if you embrace that goal, that you don't feel there's a cost-effective way of getting there?
It's not cost-effective. Cost-effectiveness is not the primary driver. Tom's absolutely right. We don't believe we can get there. We don't have the technologies that could give us confidence to get there.
Let me ask you a related question, but a slightly different one. You are packaging this stuff and sending it to where? To New Mexico? Is this going to Carlsbad?
We have several different waste streams. We have what is called transuranic waste that we would like to package and ship to the waste isolation pilot plant in New Mexico.
And I hear a lot of folks saying, listen, we don't want this stuff passing through our communities. Why not? Isn't it safer just to leave it where it is, to bottle it up and leave it there rather than ship it on trucks or trains or however you get it there all over the country? How do you respond to that argument?
There are several different responses. One is, if you've been by Rocky Flats lately, then you would probably inherently understand why it doesn't make sense. Rocky Flats doesn't have tens of miles of buffer around it, and so we don't think it's a smart thing to do to leave these materials here with residents so close by.
As a matter of fact, as I recall, you can see downtown Denver right from
absolutely
from
11
spot.
Air miles from the site.
Tom, how do you, as a citizen activist, relate to the idea of simply transferring Denver's problems to citizens of someplace else?
Well, that's exactly what would happen with most of the waste streams that Rocky Flats is dealing with. They're transferring the problems to the citizens of Utah, of New Mexico, of Nevada, etc. And we are focusing quite a bit on the WIP issue. And we have two primary concerns. One is that the facility itself is not credible, and it is technically flawed and will not contain the waste for the dangerous life of the waste. And the second is that the transportation will endanger millions of people along transportation routes, including the citizens of Colorado.
So it sounds to me like you'd rather see it sit there in Rocky Flats for a while rather than move it out. Is that correct?
With the important caveat that it needs to be in state-of-the-art storage. We don't advocate just leaving it in some old building. What we need is a very good storage facility, and we need to be assured that there will be consistent monitoring of that waste.
So Jesse, I think I hear a citizen activist saying, leave it in our community rather than send it somewhere else, which is not the usual comment. What about that?
Well, I certainly respect Tom's view, but that is not the message of the majority of the citizens as we've understood it around this site. Second point as well is from an economics point of view, the question that citizens have to ask is, do we want 10 of these sites around the country, or does it make sense to consolidate it in one place?
And I would point out two things. First is that the Department of Energy ran hearings on the waste isolation pilot plant last year. One of those occurred in Denver, and most of the people who showed up, and there was quite a large turnout on a very cold, 0-degree day, voiced opposition to the WIPP facility. And
that's the one in New Mexico.
That's right. And indicated that we should be taking responsibility for the waste. And it's not clear to me that the Department of Energy has an accurate read on what the people of Colorado would like to see happen regarding this waste. And I think that particularly if people understood the dangers posed by the transportation, we would see a very different message than
okay.
the Department of Energy.
I'm afraid our time is up. We're dealing with an issue that we're going to have plenty of time to think about, since it's going to take years and years and years and maybe thousands of years to deal with. We've been talking about nuclear waste from weapons production facilities, Rocky Flats in Colorado in particular. My guests have been Jesse Robertson, who is manager of the Rocky Flats facility. She's with the Department of Energy. And Tom Marshall, who is a spokesperson for the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center. We want to know what you think. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can hear The Environment Show anytime over the Internet. Our website is www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Alan Weisman, it's a village in Colombia, South America. In this portrait of place, Weisman reads from his book titled Gaviotas, A Village to Reinvent the World.
Paulo Lugari, the founder of Gaviotas, was never tempted by Colombia's lush resources when he set out to begin his great experiment, even though they were all around him. 90 million years earlier, South America was probably the first continental chunk to break away from the original planetary landmass, so its flora and fauna are among the most primitive on Earth. Later, North America followed, and where they joined, barely 5 million years ago, an intense biological interchange commenced. That juncture was present-day Colombia, whose topography couldn't have been more ideal for this encounter had a museum curator designed it. Because it straddles the equator, Colombia has no seasonal temperature changes, but its elevation extremes provide a range of constant climates from torrid to tundra, an ideal ecological niche for practically any form of life that arrived. As a result, Colombia has more bird species than anywhere else. It is second in plants, in amphibians, and third in reptiles. With more rivers than all of Africa, with coastlines on both the Pacific and the Caribbean, with three distinct Andean ranges separated by broad, rich valleys, Colombia's extravagant natural blessings would be the envy of the world if the world weren't otherwise distracted by the country's sorrows. But the vision gestating in Paulo Lugari's subconscious as his Land Rover crawled across Colombia's huge eastern plain known as Los Llanos in late 1966 wasn't of environmental riches, but the opposite. It involved a hunch that someday the world would become so crowded that humans would have to learn to live in the planet's least desirable areas. But where? His time working in Colombia's Pacific jungle, slated for a possible transoceanic canal, had persuaded him that rainforests and excess people were a foolish mix. But in South America alone, there were 250 million hectares of fairly empty, well-drained savannas like these llanos. One day, he was convinced, they would be the only place to put bursting human populations. Los Llanos, Colombia's rain-leached, barren, malarial eastern savannas, were a perfect setting, he decided, to design an ideal civilization for the planet's fastest-filling region, the tropics. No one held much hope for him. The Llanos were considered good for little, except inspiring llanero musicians to write songs about how mournful life gets on an endless prairie. 30,000 years earlier, biologists believed that this had been part of an unbroken rainforest clear to the Amazon. Then the new trade winds that formed over the seas to the northeast blew inland, fanning lightning strikes into fires that burned the jungle faster than woodlands could regenerate. A few fire-hardened trees were able to adapt. For the most part, the jungle receded south, where the winds diffused, leaving short-cycle, nutrient-poor savanna grasses in its stead. "It's just a big, wet desert out there," Lugari was told repeatedly. "The only deserts," he would one day reply, "are deserts of the imagination. Gaviotas is an oasis of imagination."
That was author Alan Weisman reading from his book titled Gaviotas, A Village to Reinvent the World. It's published by Chelsea Green Publishing Company. Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. If this show about the tools of war and extinction is something you have to have, call 1-888-49-GREEN and order show number 434. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the Packard Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, the Oliver S. and Jenny R. Donaldson Charitable Trust, the William Bingham Foundation, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. Be good to the earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.